turn off my phone. Is that Kiss?
Yeah.
And God, is,
you know, I need some tones on you, my friend.
Why do you need tones from me? There's nothing.
Tones on Tail, because they're a great band.
How about Toads and Toads? How about Peter Toad?
How about Toad the Wet Sprocket?
How about I think I'm a toad, but I think I'm going to jump?
I don't know that one.
I don't know it either, but I just made it up.
Okay.
It'd make a great title. Don't you think that'd make a great title for a song?
Cat Hair in My Pocket.
Cat Hair in Your Pocket?
Great name of a band.
How about Cats in Your... Cats and your cats and your dogs.
Sean the other day goes, I got cat hair in my pocket. We all kind of looked at each other. I said, that's a great name for a band.
Okay. Are we done? We got enough here?
Not yet.
Come on, Jesus, what are you doing over here?
He's beating our sound man for all the podcasts.
Yeah, well, he's obviously we've got a problem then.
So
you can start anytime you want.
Oh, can I?
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, have you been rolling the whole time is the real question.
No, just the last minute or two.
Okay, so I want to start out with another story time.
Once upon a time?
Once upon a time, there was a band named the Beatles.
Weebles.
And they have a history of making hits and having some wry humor in their songs that sometimes is not expected. So I want to talk about the song Norwegian Wood. It's a nice little ditty and mainly known for the sitar work of George Harrison, because he brought sitar into a major sort of a song by the Beatles. But I want to talk about the lyrics and the story behind the song is. In an interview, Paul McCartney said that this is all about John Lennon's extramarital affair he had, where the woman involved rejected him at the end and walked away from the affair. And so this is his response to it. What's interesting is that the idea of Norwegian wood, I didn't know any of this, but Paul said that Norwegian wood was the cheapest paneling that was used in apartments in London about that time. And so when he says Norwegian wood, isn't it good? It's sort of a little comment about the type of apartment this was in. And then the second response to, or second mention of, I lit a fire, oh, Norwegian wood, isn't it good? Paul very explicitly said, this is about a guy who was angry about the end of an affair, so he burned the house down.
Wow. Did John actually burn the house down?
No. This is what he wanted to do.
Oh, I see.
He didn't do it, but that's what the song is about, is burning the house down.
So sort of like a pre-David Byrne, burning down the house. But without burning down the house.
I can't listen to this song anymore without thinking, and now he's going to burn the house down.
You brought an image in my mind of David Byrne.
Yep.
What was the song Burning Down the House?
Oh, well, I tell you, I know that story too.
So tell me that story.
So they invited the Parliament Funkadelic keyboard player into their band.
Okay.
This was
80s.
This is right before the Burning Down the House song came, that album came out, and I don't remember which album that is. But he had heard them play while they were sort of getting...
He heard Parliament play.
No, this guy had heard Talking Heads play. And
so
his comment was to them, you're burning down the house. And David Byrne had no idea what that meant. And had to ask, like, what do you mean burning down the house? It means you were hot. You were great. It's like...
He smoked him.
So David Byrne's response to that is to write a song about burning down the house, a big funky song. And it is, it's a great funky song. But then make a video that's literally burning down the house. It's kind of funny because he, in David Byrne's style, took a real compliment and sort of turned it on its head and talked about burning down the house.
You know, the funny thing about that song is when you think about it, it has such a great series of hooks to it.
Right.
There are a number of great hooks to it. So did the keyboard player write the hooks? Did David Byrne write the hooks? Who wrote the music? So if David Byrne...
A story for another day.
So if David Byrne wrote the lyrics for that, the question is, who wrote the music? Was it a member of Talking Heads? Or was it was the keyboard player of the Parliaments? What was his name?
I'll get back to you on all of those things.
Stay tuned all the parts of that second part of the story when we tell that story next time.
Yep.
So given that we've got an accusation previously made by Walden to me that said, I always dominate the topics. I figured that what I said to Walden was that today is your choice of topics, and I'm just going to respond to the topics. But because I do recall in a previous podcast, Walden said, Lenny always does the topics. So, Walden, what's your topic for today?
So, first,
It's on tape.
I'm sure it is. The topic tonight is going to be one that's near and dear to my heart.
He's got a heart, Bradley.
I know. Thank you.
And it's not Patti Smith either.
Yeah.
We are going to talk about Patti Smith. So.
So there you go. It's his heart.
But that's not where we're headed to begin with. It's the idea of rock genres, and I have I spend a lot of time, answering questions on Quora about rock. And one of the amazing topics that comes up continuously is, what is classic rock? Mm. What is goth rock? What is punk rock? What is post-punk rock?
What is prog rock?
What is prog rock? What is...
God rock.
And you get through
Let me write them down over here.
Yeah, and there's what is metal? What is speed metal? What is heavy metal? What is just metal? Who was the first of,
what is new age? What is old age?
New wave.
No, old age is us.
Power pop. Alt rock, college rock, there's all these different genres.
Isn't it whatever KTEL defines it as?
No, that's Renko, please.
Renko, thank you.
Or Billboard, interestingly enough, Billboard has a alt rock.
Pop rock.
Pop rock album.
Alt rock.
Blues.
Alt rock.
Has different Billboard lists, right? And so those I can almost buy as genres only because Billboard calls them something. But they're not genres in the sense they're musical genres. They're radio genres.
Well, I was about to say, doesn't that come from...
And that would carry over to the cable when you turn on your cable TV, you have all these music channels that are broken down into all those different genres.
Well, this is the...
What's the source of truth here?
Well, the source of truth here is the 60s and 70s where AM radio used to start it off with top 40 hits rock. Whether you want to go to the WABCs of the world or LSs of the world, where it was the top 5 or 10 or 20 songs that you had going on over there, and the LS or whoever would count down the top 10.
Right.
And, if you lived in L.A., top 40 hit station or hit machine was. Fast forward to the 90s and Z100 in New York with their version of the top hits to the Casey Kasem, we're going to count down the top 100.
Right. So all of that makes sense until we hit streaming, and now streaming has taken over the whole notion of what a top hit is, because number of streams equals number of sales. I mean, they have a Billboard has this very complex, right, algorithm to figure out what is the number one hit, what is the number one quote unquote album, and it's not based on sales anymore. It's based on streaming plus sales.
But it's interesting that you pointed out, because if you look at something like Sirius FM or Sirius XM.
Right.
Which is the combination of what used mm-hmm. to be XM and Sirius. Now, when they merged, they have about 200 channels of streaming music that they've categorized, whether it's cool jazz or top 70s or 80s or 90s or 2000s or 60s or mm-hmm. 50s or whatever you want to categorize that. You know, it's kind of interesting that they have, if you would, attempted to, you know, album rock. So album rock came out of the significant emergence of FM radio.
Right.
FM radio
late
became...
Late 60s, early 70s,
FM radio yep. came out where stereophonic, for those of you... Well, stereophonic albums being played on the radio with better quality than AM. This predates the current AM version of where they're able to have quality. But you had stereo... ability to play music on FM, and they also were willing to play not just the hit, but the longer versions of it. So the Doors, Light My Fire.
We were talking about that today. Inna Gotta Da Vida, Frankenstein.
Right. Well, yeah, but even Inna Gotta Da Vida, I don't think would maybe once a week might make it because it was 27 minutes long.
But they had a three-minute version of it right. for AM short play FM radio. Then they had a 7-minute for long play, and then at midnight,
NEW New York.
We had a station in Detroit, WABX, that would just play the album sides.
Right. Yep. And New York at WNEW, which was the really album oriented.
AOR.
I don't know what it was called
at the time. What was the midnight hour called? I just lost it. Somebody's midnight hour.
Wolfman Jack.
No, it wasn't Wolfman Jack. But there was a.
Nationally syndicated.
It was nationally syndicated, and at midnight they'd play a whole album. Or a concert.
All these guys used to do that, but it's interesting. When you look at it that way, because as Bradley pointed out, we were listening to Frankenstein earlier today by Edgar Winter, I was
some Rick Derringer too.
And McCoy used to play, was in the band also. Ooh. from the McCoys, Rick McCoy was in the band also, and so I wanted to figure out who played all the instruments. Who was the dominant player of all the instruments? Anybody?
In where?
On Frankenstein.
Well, it was Edgar.
How many instruments did he play?
No, he played the whole album.
He played almost everything.
Right.
On the album was Edgar, but when he went to go tour, he had to get Derringer and Rick McCoy and his brother Johnny.
Similar to Crosby, Stills, Nash,
right,
first
and
album.
Stephen Stills. Yeah, Stephen Stills. Thing, yep. And I never realized until I really, and as we've been talking about it, diving into who actually recorded it and who actually did the work on the album.
So I'm going to grab that whole conversation and put it aside and go back to my topic
sounds like Lenny's dominating again.
So no, this is not about him dominating, but I really want to get to this one.
But I would say classic rock didn't really come in until you had. That's a generational thing.
So there's classic rock stations. It's a radio.
But that's a new term.
The last 20, 30
term.
Years.
That's a 2000 term.
In the 90s, we had classic rock. In the 80s, but every time you redefine classic rock, you add another 10 years.
You had classic rock, but also the generational. You had the oldies.
And the oldies, and you had the 50s.
Color bougie!
Right. So, but there's radio genres, but to me those aren't really genres. That's just classifications so you can talk about a decade or whatever. But the question for music, rock has a quality and some things to it. Jazz has something to blues has some. They have musical definable qualities. So when you have a subgenre of something that has a musical quality to it, I would expect there to be some defining musical something that makes goth rock a goth rock.
Or punk rock, or an artist or a recording show. What's the first punk rock song that comes to mind? Oh, sorry, I hit the mic.
The first punk rock
song that comes to mind in your mind?
I would have
God Save the Queen. I don't know. There's a million punk rock songs. The term punk rock was actually written long before there was punk rock music, and labeled punk rock music. It was in the early 70s.
CBGB.
And before CBGBs, it was actually Lenny Kaye was a Patti Smith's guitarist.
From Max's Kansas City.
No.
But he played Ice Room Max's.
But he was also a rock journalist. He was working in a record store, writing on the side as a rock journalist, and he called Iggy Pop and Lou Reed some punks.
Right. They're hanging out in Max's.
And he was talking about these garage bands. And that's how the term punk rock came about, it was these punks. And it wasn't about the music. It was about people being punks.
Like the Ramones.
And so then...
So it was a person, not a genre, or not a musical style.
So that's what I'm getting at, is that some of these genres... Now, punk rock, if all we're talking about is garage bands, I mean, then The Who was a... punk band at one point.
Well, I would argue that The Who was originally a punk band.
Yeah.
They might have been one of those seminal sort of early days.
Well, I will say, my generation may be the first punk hit.
Well, sort of like, and I forget who it was, I think it was Paul McCartney recently was quoted saying that the Rolling Stones, no, they were a blues band.
A blues cover band.
And they were back in the early days of the 60s. Yeah. They were, and they went to Chess Records, they traveled to Chicago, and they were a blues cover band.
But did he call the Beatles a rock and roll cover band, Little Richard cover band, because that's what they were?
Well, true. I would accept that.
I know. That's fine. You know, so there's this root sort of thought about, that I'm thinking that punk rock could be about the similar days of a lot of bands starting out. They're punk.
So were the Doors a spoken word band?
Well, they met.
Ooh.
I would say the Doors might have been the first art band. I'll buy
that.
Spoken
word.
When Manzarek and Morrison met, that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. So the spoken word band.
They were
spoken word. It's just like Gil Scott-Heron, and Donny Hathaway were the first rappers. Who were also spoken word, and don't forget that they were part of the Last Poets.
By the way, thanks for the Donny Hathaway.
Sorry. That's okay.
So, bringing back Patti Smith, because I have to do it.
Three times in the whole show, that's all.
The third time's going to be a long time. So she mentions...
Walden's obsessed with Patti, by the way.
Lou Reed, Jim Morrison, Bob Dylan. She said, those are the three.
Those are the American ones.
That paved the way for her. Spoken rock poetry. And she clearly points to those three as the three big names that...
Where's Leonard Cohen fit into that?
She didn't mention Leonard Cohen. I'm just curious
if you...
He's definitely a poet that wrote music. I'm not going to say he's a better poet than a better musician, but he's, if one part of his life had to go away, it would be the music, because he's a poet.
No, he's a poet.
Right? So, I mean, I'm not saying it should have. He obviously took time off from his music. He came back at the end with a great, phenomenal album. But it's like sort of, you know, he's always been in two genres, if you will, both the written word and the music.
So did Morrison take a break from being a poet to be a rock star and then come back to it at the end of his short-term career?
No, because he continued writing throughout his whole career.
So he still wrote poetry. But well, I'm saying, but, so, he, so had, but a, he had a rock. He had a rock star, you know, of not just rock star. He was a rock god of that era.
So Peace Frog, right. Song, right? People often say, "Oh, that's about the riots in Chicago," or "That's about it's an anti-war song." And what it turns out is Morrison has he would write he had notebooks and notebooks right. and notebooks of poetry, and
he'd find the lyrics, he'd find the pieces to put together.
That song is a pastiche of about five different things, personal things in his life, you know, that happened, that he just threw all together to make a song about, and he never once explained to the band or to anyone. He just called it Peace Frog in the studio.
So
need a name for this.
Exactly. So they just finally published it as Peace Frog.
So what, in your recollection, did he describe the end to be?
I don't know.
Because that would be a very interesting thing. Because it's described to be the Vietnam War, made famous, by Coppola's use of it in the movie. It's been described as the end of an era. Because, you know, if you would, the loss of innocence in America, and that whole American dream.
Well, Morrison, it was probably many things.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I was just curious to know what, others. So there's an interesting question that comes up in my mind a lot, which is, we could all hypothesize, and Walden, you and I do this a lot, of what the song might mean. But the question really is, when you think of it, is what did the writer actually mean by it? It's sort of like when you design an art piece, the artist says, "Well, you'll never understand what my art means because it's in my mind and I'm not going to share it." Or some artists do talk about it.
So I will say that there's more speculation about Jim Morrison because he died.
Right.
And he certainly, his lyrics aren't necessarily straightforward, clear lyrics. They're poetic in nature. Often the allusions to different things are personal symbol systems of Jim Morrison. Now, what's interesting is to hear his band talk about the songs and lyrics and how they came about, because often they're as surprised as,
a little different perspective.
Yeah, because, they'll start jamming on something. I mentioned this about Riders on the Storm. They were jamming on, this whole other song, and all of a sudden Jim says, "Oh, I got the lyrics for this." It just starts going someplace about the hitchhiker and this and that. And it was never an intention of writing that song. It just came out about because something clicked in Jim's head. He took two different whole things plus a movie he'd been in, sort of threw them all together, and meanwhile the Doors are just cooking, and because they trusted Jim. No matter what was coming out,
they were going to find some way.
It was going to get in the flow. So that's really interesting with Jim, because now there's all these questions with Robbie Krieger on what did Jim mean by this? Well, he never told me. I have some ideas,
right?
But they're just ideas.
That's what I'm saying is that you one might want to place an interpretation on something, but you don't really know unless you get the artist to choose to reveal what it meant to them.
Right.
And maybe they never want to reveal it because it's something so private in nature that they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, so you might find something written, like with John Lennon. Now you have Paul McCartney talking about John Lennon songs, finally, things like that. Or you have other people, when they die, then things come out, Or when you get older and they write an autobiography, they might write about oh, yeah, I worked with, you know, Steven Stills on this song, and this is how we did it, blah, 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 you know, this sort of thing. And you finally get some context for some of those songs that were written 50 years ago. But it is interesting because the internet allows, because a lot of people knew singers and songwriters and know the, a lot of backstory because they actually knew them, and they're quite willing to talk about. The problem is, who's really talking about something that's personal and who's just
making up
stories?
Yeah, exactly.
So you have to filter through a lot of things, and some things ring true, and some things clearly, you know.
So I'm going to take you back to your categorization thing, and I'm going to bring up a genre, if you would. You know, and I don't know that it's the right phrase for it, but orchestra rock.
So whether it's the Moody Blues,
it's like a Moody Blues kind of thing or something, or ELO.
Right. Traditionally, that is thrown into prog rock because the
progressive
rock, because the definition is so strange. But the definition I see thrown around for prog rock is the use of non-standard rock, you know, instruments.
So does that mean Jethro Tull?
Jethro Tull is the one of the most famous prog rock bands of all time.
I was about to say.
What about Yes?
Yes is a prog rock band.
They use all standard instruments.
But second part of the definition.
Define.
There's a number of definitions.
Emerson, Lake and Palmer.
Sounds like. Yeah, two syllables.
Also a prog rock. But long, predominantly long songs.
Genesis.
so it's not the style. It's long.
Right. It's long. It's use of
goofy instruments.
Goofy instruments. And it's odd key signatures.
I can get the odd key signatures. Yeah. That I can get, you know.
So,
and the non-traditional instrument for that genre.
But when I listen to not only long songs, but like rock operas.
So like, is Tommy?
Tommy is a prog rock. The Wall is prog rock. Argus with Wishbone Ash is prog rock.
But if you go into song length, that would probably put
2112
right?
or whatever the Rush.
The Dead are still playing the same.
The Dead are still playing the same.
All of Alan Parsons is prog rock. You know.
Wow.
What's
his name? Michael Oldham or Oldenheim? You know the play of the song that from the 80s. I'll just remember it. It's Mike.
What did Mike do?
It's
Mike Oldfield, Tubular Bells?
Tubular Bells, thank you very much.
And he played all those instruments.
Yes, Tubular Bells is also prog rock.
That's what I was thinking of, Tubular Bells. So there was a couple of different songs. MacArthur's Park.
Right.
That was about 18 minutes long.
No, it was like 12 minutes long.
Which version?
The AM, the FM short, or the AOR?
No, I'm thinking the disco version by,
There was a disco version of MacArthur Park.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I think I actually forcefully missed that.
Was it Donna Summer?
It was Donna Summer.
Yeah.
And it's a whole side of an album.
Oh, no, I heard that
one. Giorgio.
Yes, that one I heard.
And they had three or four mixes on that.
I think now that you remind me, you registered that in
my... But the first version...
Yes.
Was by, what's his name from Camelot?
Richard.
Yeah.
And why, you know, Whiter Shade of Pale?
Whiter Shade of Pale is perhaps, well, all of. Progo Harum is interesting.
That was more psychedelic rock, wasn't it?
So Progo Harum doesn't necessarily fit into the. But because it's orchestral, it's prog rock.
But it's Fripp.
No, it wasn't.
Fripp, was it on that?
No. That is. Procol Harum had, what's his name?
Isn't that Fripp?
Bridge of Sighs. Trower.
Robin Trower, I think.
Was it Robin Trower or
Procol
Harum?
But I think that Fripp was on either a session or something.
Maybe. Regardless, you're on to something. Here's this orchestral, you know, a flute. So a lot of Traffic is progressive rock, you know? I mean,
40,000 Henman.
Yeah, exactly, right? So, you know, and
which I would never have categorized
so
as prog rock. You know, I thought that I think that if I think of if Traffic comes to mind in my head, I'm back in the 60s.
Well, yeah, 60s, you know, early 70s.
But you listen to Traffic now. I mean, Low Spark of High Heel Boys is just. That whole album is just fantastic.
Phenomenal. Right. Yeah, but I say, but is it so a prog rock? No, come on.
So it's obviously classic rock because we don't have to classify
generational.
It. Generational. Yeah. But on the other hand, it's very it's not totally mainstream rock, but it is pretty mainstream for that era.
It was way mainstream. I remember going to I know I'm showing my age again, but going to a Traffic concert, there was a lot of long-haired hippie boys.
I know.
And girls in that audience.
I'm including yourself. Right?
But
I wasn't long-haired.
But if you think about Traffic, Jefferson Airplane, I mean, there's a whole...
Well, yeah, but Airplane is not prog rock.
No.
But, Airplane was rock.
They're psychedelic rock.
Yeah, well, they're acid
what I'm
rock.
Saying is they had the same exact audiences.
Well, so right? Is an audience is a genre defined by an audience?
Sometimes, which is really weird. So, I mean, when you think about punk rock, and this is where I wanted to go with punk rock is you have the Ramones, clearly the America's first punk rock band. Everyone calls it that. Then you have The Clash. You have the Sex Pistols. You have the early Blondie, not the late Blondie, but the early Blondie.
Early Police?
No. They are, unfortunately, post-punk power
television.
Post-punk power pop. Okay.
How about Television?
Television is a unique one because it fits right in that post-punk. Punk.
I love Television.
Me too. And there's so many great bands right there, you know, that. But if you look at a common element in all these bands, that were called punk bands, and then you go to this.
There was a common element, Patti Smith.
No, but you're gonna. I'm gonna add Patti Smith to that bunch. I'm gonna add the Slits, the Cramps,
Iggy Pop.
Here's all these bands. What's the common element? They all had punks in the audience.
So the audience judged the genre.
So I will argue with you at having been there that the early audiences for the Ramones were not a punk audience.
Right.
The early Ramones audience were Long Island high school and college kids that wanted to get away from mom and dad out in Long Island and smoke a little dope. And bring some hard liquor or beer or something like
some
that.
Boone's Farm.
But they were not, you know, I could tell you the countless number of nights where I was there and you didn't see a punk in the crowd. You'd have to travel into Manhattan to CBGB's, you know, which the Ramones did, you know, as well play there. And the crowd there was radically different,
right? So
and it wasn't until two or three years later, really, that you would see.
You're making my point for me. This is exactly the point I would never if I had heard the Ramones. I mean, I woke up today. I'd never lived through the 70s. I'd never lived through the 80s.
You didn't,
and I. Well, I might not remember everything, but
I was gonna say they say if you remember it, you weren't there. You know.
So. But if I just heard their albums, right? How would I characterize
bubblegum rock?
They're sort of like throwbacks to the 50s, sort
Flow
of,
and
you know,
Eddies.
You know,
they're almost a Flo and Eddie kind of band.
Okay, so that's fine.
I would put them in that sort of
Zappa's orchestral rock, though.
Zappa
was progressive before they had a name.
Zappa, and to the early period of time for George Clinton. When he was with Zappa and they were all sort of jamming, playing together, I don't know that I could really classify or categorize them effectively because there was nothing.
He's stealing my thunder.
There was nothing that existed like early Zappa. of that era.
No, I agree.
There was. I mean, it was
to
just
this day. There's nothing. Right,
you. I mean, blow your mind.
Like
blow your mind. Stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Weasels eat. You know, eat my brains.
Oh,
are you kidding me?
Brown cheese don't make it.
I'm just like, you know, Dynamo, go huh? into Montana soon. You know, it's like, are you kidding me?
So
well, who would ever think of something like that? Let alone how he convinced Capitol Records to let him put out the record.
Well, that's another.
Thank
whole,
God.
Well, they did make him change his name.
Yeah, but still, my God.
So,
I just thank God that they that we have that stuff recorded.
So, back to punk rock genre. I have a problem with the idea that punk rock is a musical genre. I don't mind calling it a genre of the era. I mean, there was punks, and it was, but I find nothing in common between all of these bands. And I want to go right to the heart of my thesis. When I listen to
pardon me, Professor Miller, it's going to come through the heart of his thesis.
I told you what I was going to tell you. Now I'm telling you. Now I'm going to tell you what I just told you.
I think I'm going through the heart of rock and roll. Huey Lewis and the News.
Oh.
Hang on, let me dim the lights here.
No, wait. The heart of rock and roll.
So if I listen to these albums without trying to remember, like, oh, that was she's a punker, he's a punker, he's like, and I just listen to it. I think Patti Smith, music, forget, take all the lyrics away just for a minute. If you listen to music, it is pure 60s rock. It is I mean, everything they play could have been done by Jefferson Airplane or Steppenwolf or something. It's like, it's very, like, and I'm not saying it's not bad or good. I'm just saying there's nothing that sounds like anything like the Ramones, Sex Pistols, Television. You go to. So I listen to it. What makes her punk is that all the punksters loved her because she herself was just this poet artist like Jim Morrison who enjoyed spoken poetry on the stage. And so she fits more into the Lou Reed school.
So I was, about to say. So,
Roxy music.
That Lou Reed... You know, era, yeah. If you would, with Nico,
yep.
And Patty, and all of those folks. You mentioned. You know, I'm thinking of Mott the Hoople,
right?
Bowie in that early era. There were a category of people that were hanging out at Max's in New York City, and I was one of them. I admit it. Who were there for different reasons. So there was no one, you know, and it was Warhol era and everything else, but there was no one categorization other than the fact that people were just trying to explore their mind of what the heck that was about.
Yeah, stretching the limits of what music was about. And
life was about. I don't think just music.
Well,
and what art, what poetry, what performance, performance art.
Right.
We go back to that, those words. I mean, I remember doing a piece with Twyla Tharp and
Grecian Urns.
He was dancing.
Yeah. And it was to Philip Glass, yeah. And some Bowie stuff,
huh.
And it was blow your mind kind of stuff. And you guys know what electroacoustic music is?
Yeah,
is it a genre?
No, it's not a genre. It's a terminology that takes the sound of the music, converts the acoustical timbre into electrical impulse, which then translates into lights. It's what we use for, you know, in the Joshua Light Show era.
Mm-hmm.
To actually, so if you look at the late 60s, early 70s rock shows, that's what we were using. We were using these converters, which would take the music sound or the sound itself and turn it into
frequencies.
Into frequencies, which turned it
so
into light.
You get pulsing on,
right,
from
you get
the
pulsation.
Rhythm,
you get changing
mics.
Right.
For different lights.
Versus pouring oil and water on top of a slide projector or something?
Yeah, it's completely different. It was a completely different. You know,
I got a story about that.
I'm sure you do.
So, I mean, I had a group of guys from the JBs come in and we recorded some stuff and then layered it over. So you have this weird kind of funky sort of raspy, you know, saxophone horn kind of thing, you know, hard drum beat thing going on with these dancers, and it was like they were in, and so there were some live performances that we did that was like you didn't know what was going to happen, mind you, and we used to stack big box televisions where each mic was linked to a television, so the colors of the televisions on the CRT screens were linked to an instrument. So your sax was that, and your horn was that, and the dancers.
Pure analog.
It was so wild.
So Bowie did that. Iggy Pop did that.
Right, right. So that's what I'm saying.
Deal.
It was Bowie was involved.
Yep.
There was a bunch of wild.
So, in the 80s, let's say, when I was trying to get in bands again, or late 70s. We were poor, but we wanted special effects. So what we did is we went out to Goodwill and bought turntables and put in colored lights
on
the center of the turntable. And then we take...
Rotate the lights.
Better than that. So the lights were in the middle and they were turned on. But then we take a paper towel insert, you know, tall, and then we'd cut out different shapes. and it would spin. The lights would be, so we'd have these, we'd put three or four of those up on the stage, and you'd have this sort of light show going on. It's dirt cheap, but it worked.
Until you hit 78, and just everybody just ran
them. Oh, no, you had to go on a slow speed. 33 was the
16, I think.
16 was the slowest.
Yeah.
On the setting.
Anyway, but I want to get back. When I think of...
Is that a Beatles reference? I'm sorry.
The Cure.
JoJo.
What is The Cure, for
a
genre?
For me, it was punk.
Right. But they would say they came out in 78. Punk was over. Punk was dead.
They're more goth, dark,
just
glam.
Because the time of that era passed doesn't change the fact that the band was a certain thing.
Right. So
but it's just called something different.
Right.
They come out later.
So they're characterized as post-punk, goth, and something else. I can't remember.
Neo-gothic punk.
And
plus tax.
Alt, of course, alt, because they're not mainstream.
Alt.
The one I love the best is indie. Indie rock.
So you mentioned something interesting there. They're classified as all that. But they came out with a lot of top 40 stuff.
Right. So now, I would like to say.
So that's
another definition. I'm going to use Blondie as perhaps my best example of this. When Blondie started out, she was wearing like garbage bags and screaming, and they looked punk. They acted punk. They were pretty raw.
They were at CBGB.
And they were very, very raw. Now, 3 years later, they sign with
Atlantic Records.
Atlantic, I think it was, and put out Parallel Lines.
Which was a great album.
And all of a sudden, they're not punk.
No, they're mainstream rock.
They are mainstream rock. Right?
And then
2 years later, they're doing rap.
Right.
And so they're edgy mainstream rock, you know? But here's their career, clearly, successful. But they started as one thing, ended as something else, had something in the middle. And I think
a number of musicians do that, though.
Exactly.
So the good musician that constantly reinvents himself.
We were talking about that a few casts ago about Bob, about where he started and where he's at right now, and all the 97 spots in the middle.
Right. So again, The Cure, I'll say, they probably started out very punkish in their first couple albums, which don't sound at all like their middle albums or their late albums. But there's this progression they've made through it. But we tend to, as a, you know, as fans, oh, they're a punk band.
Well,
they're
so again, band. Going back to the Stones, who were a blues cover band that became a rock and roll band and the hardest working rock band, to the Beatles, who were a Chuck Berry, one would say, cover band, who became what?
So,
who became one?
And now you're coming to my last little question. Great bands like the Beatles, like David Bowie,
define their own genre?
Are somehow undefinable in genre terms. I mean, what
transcend?
They transcend genre. They're
not all of them.
Not all of them. No. The Stones have stayed pretty
rock and roll.
They're pretty much a rock band.
Yeah, rock blues band. Yep. So, but what would you call Pink Floyd?
I would call Floyd a alternate band.
Alternate. Yeah, right. Which doesn't
with a little bit of orchestral, prog, which is a little bit of indie, which is a little bit of careful with that axe, Eugene.
Right. So there's certain bands I think that just transcend genre.
Yes.
But I think the higher you go up in the hierarchy, they are a rock band.
Oh yeah. So
where you start splitting hairs is on the lower.
Yeah. I think I'll say the Beatles fall under rock, as does Pink Floyd, as does David Bowie,
as does the Rolling Stones,
as does the Who,
and that umbrella, which I start out with, there is an umbrella for rock. I get that, but when you start doing subgenres, it's like things start falling apart really, really fast.
Interesting one that doesn't fall in that model is jazz, because there are definitely a bebop. There's definitely a cool jazz. There is definitely genres
smooth
like that. Cool jazz, smooth jazz, however you want to describe it. There are what I would call categories for jazz, you know, straight ahead, which to this day, if you said to a jazz, you know, fan or jazz aficionado, which I would consider myself certainly a fan, if not more, that I could sit here and suggest to you that there are very, very defined, you know, big band, you know, that still to this day, regardless of era, exist and are used to describe artists.
So I would say blues fall in the same category.
There's like five
different sort of genres of blues. And, you know, it's Mississippi blues, it's Chicago blues, Delta blues. I mean, we know this. But it
fits into that category. That's more of a geographical.
No, but it's actually musical as well. The musical heritage is that those geographical areas actually sound different. Texas blues is different than Louisiana blues.
Oh, Texas blues, sure.
So what grew up there, I mean, it's all under the blues, you know, category, but what grew up in Chicago did not grow up in Memphis. It did not grow up in New Orleans or in
Mississippi
Texas.
Mississippi Delta.
You know, Kansas City, whatever. So, and they're different, and blues players know the difference. And they can talk about, well, we're going to play a little Chicago blues now. We're going to play a little, you know, Delta blues now.
So one of my favorite parts of the world is NOLA, New Orleans, as you know. And New Orleans has some very distinct, unique genres that exist. Zydeco.
Yeah.
Is a great one, you know, where people, and some people think that Zydeco is, that's what New Orleans is, but Zydeco is not what New Orleans is.
Zydeco is more of a Cajun.
Zydeco is more Cajun.
A little
swamp music. And you have a lot of other things that are out there in New Orleans. But if you walk into a joint in New Orleans, you could hear and feel, I mean, feel the difference in the band when you walk in. You know, if you walk down Frenchman Street and you go walk into the five or six joints along Frenchman Street on a Friday night, you might hear five different styles of music, and somebody who is uneducated sounds wrong, and I don't mean it like that, but not familiar enough with the styles.
But they'll notice it's different.
But they'll try to categorize it as the same,
right,
and don't realize that these are unique to New Orleans, but they are unique.
I mean, there's onto a big themselves. Difference between
so, I totally buy that. I totally buy the jazz.
And again, it doesn't
blues.
And it doesn't and it transcends years.
So what happened? Why is rock so odd?
Because rock became, I think, the first major media category because of the explosion of AM and FM radio in the 60s. You know, everybody talks about the internet era, but I want to go back to that moment in the 60s and 60s particularly, where the 60s were, although it was a big television area because television started to explode, but for people of that age group, of which I am, it was a big, everybody had a radio. Everybody had a portable AM, a portable FM.
It was the transistor.
Right.
Took the big console tube set and put it in your hand.
Right, and just like the Walkman, just like now the MP3 player, just like now the music on your phone, there is something that happened in that moment where you could be...
Well, it Walden, to the masses.
Walden was living in Des Moines, but he could listen to WLS.
No, I couldn't, but I wish I could have.
But you know what I
you
mean.
You could probably listen to CKLW at night.
But on a clear night, you know, people heard Wolfman Jack from Tijuana, Mexico.
Yeah.
They heard him across Texas, and they heard him across California, and that's how Wolfman Jack became famous, just like Alan Reed, just like Cousin Brucey in New York. These are the guys of that era. The guy from Jonathan Schwartz, who became the FM god, so to speak, and Allison Steele. You know, these were those people of that era, just like Alan Freed in the 50s, but the transistor radio had just barely hit the surface. But you had that music on the beach, in your hand, in your car.
And you had the radio stations. And, you know, one genre we didn't touch on, but something that's close to... Lenny and I's near and dear his heart is soul music. Detroit, Philly. You know what I mean? All of these, much like the jazz, where you say, yeah, that's kind of soul music, but it's
soul out of, is somewhere in between blues and jazz, and you know, like it's like
so. So is soul R&B? Is R&B soul? Is
that's the genre right there?
Yeah, you know. So that it's a fun. It's just a funny sort of characterization.
So blues and soul had a baby, and they called it rock and roll. Is that what this?
Yeah, something like that.
Developed out of that, but
something like that. But it's interesting that there are people who can't separate between R&B and soul.
And then you have the two, you know.
So R&B and soul are very close, but they're not the same. But again, it's an interesting problem when you start thinking about, you know, early soul, early rock and roll, early blues in the 60s. Now, I'm not going to go into the 50s, but in the 60s,
You're talking like Sam and Dave, that kind of stuff? Or more along Ella Fitzgerald? Or
Motown.
James Brown, Motown, you know. This is, we're at this point where...
Stax Volt.
Stax Volt.
I was just going to say, now you're defining by record label, right. Motown, Stax.
Well, you have to because they owned...
They owned
the categorization...
Sun Records, Chess Records.
Of their own.
You know, these are...
But Sun was more...
Son had Elvis.
Yeah, and had more. I'm gonna. It's the wrong
gospel.
Categorization, but they had some rockabilly and some, and what they called
Carl Perkins.
What was it? There was a derogatory term used in the 50s, race records.
Race records.
So race records became okay as soon as the white singer sang it.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that, and as Chuck Berry said, you know, I'm still owed billions of dollars, you know, from the songs that got ripped off from me, just like Bo Diddley.
I was watching a special on the other night about that, and they had Pat Boone was singing the song where somebody else was.
Well, so, and I'll say all those record labels had houses of, you know, and they kept their singers tight-knit, but they had a stable of writers for those singers, because clearly it wasn't until the mid-60s to late-60s that singer-songwriters were always preferred, as opposed to early-60s, and clearly in the 50s, singer-songwriters were not the norm.
Rare.
They were rare.
But would that be more of the corporation?
It was a music machine.
It was a music industry.
They were looking for perfect voices or great voices or voices they thought
that could sell records.
That would sell records for them.
Whereas singer-songwriters are breaking away from that genre.
So you think about it. So Carole King and her husband, back in the late 50s when they started out,
they were songwriters.
Worked in the Brill Building. Were staff songwriters, would write all those hits. Would pen them to such an extent that millions of people would see that and say, "Oh, I want to sing that song." You know, I got, you know, Wedding Bell Blues, all those kind of songs that they wrote. And it wasn't until she made it in 69 or 70 then decided, "I'm gonna have my own voice."
Well, Tapestry was the one that really launched her out of that.
And that actually was her relationship with
James Taylor,
who pushed her
to be a singer.
Because
you could do it.
Because James Taylor has a good voice, but it's not a great voice.
But their friendship. Their love affair, one might argue.
And James Taylor has his own genre, too.
I'm not sure he has a genre.
No, James Taylor has his own lover's tales that he can tell.
So, yeah.
Can you name all of them?
Smokey Robinson, same way.
Yeah, but Smokey is an industry unto himself.
Well, back then, he was a writer.
Well, and he was a performer, and he was a arranger, so he did a lot.
Well, so I'll say the history around Motown was unique in that they had talent, and they had so much talent
that
they allowed like Smokey to do everything, because he turned everything to gold. I mean, honestly, there was no
Smokey, Marvin Gaye.
He was an industry into himself.
Right.
One of the most prolific, if not the most prolific songwriter of all time. I think the last count was 6,700 songs. Could you imagine having written 6,700 songs, still to this day, in the studio with hip hop artists and rap artists, doing new mix ups and new songs.
It's phenomenal.
87, Stevie Wonder, 87 years old. Could you imagine? So you're right, Stevie. Stevie is another one of those guys that, you know, I've been doing a lot of deep dive of Stevie studio recordings, odd things, non-released stuff. There is a ton of stuff that I'm waiting. It's sort of like waiting for the Prince Vault to get released.
Stevie, he's some of those guys that crossed the big umbrella from rock.
Well, Stevie's done everything. R&B he's an industry unto himself, because he's been able to transcend genres and transcend errors and transcend categorization.
Right.
Transcendental meditation.
So what are we doing?
A little Mahavishnu here?
There's someone who's transcended.
Right into the ditch.
So I thought we were going to the Ravi Shankar moment.
Then we're back to George Harrison and
that's who taught George how to play the sitar.
So actually,
you didn't know that?
No, I knew that.
So what was funny, I read it.
And was it Nora Jones, his daughter?
I was reading about Norwegian Wood, and Ringo contributed this little nugget. George couldn't afford a good sitar, so he bought the cheapest sitar he could find in London, and that's what he was playing on Norwegian Wood. It was just something he had picked up in a shop because he couldn't find a quality instrument.
Well, they were only in India were they really making them.
Well, he didn't bring one home with
him. It's sort of like, you know, sort of like when Paul Simon went to Africa, I think it was, and picked up all those instruments that he played in the 90s and 80s.
Yeah, with Chevy Chase?
Yeah.
That's a different...
You can call me Steve.
Something. You guys are bad.
No, but so that's really the gist of what I wanted to get at with genres, because it really is, to me, it's fascinating how much we talk about different genres and how much we also talk about them as if they had a musical definition to them, and I don't really buy it. I buy rock's a definition, but we start talking about, well, the Beatles are so different. I mean.
Well, when you start getting the fringes, you...
Well, so the moment you get below the big umbrella, rock just sort of falls apart in terms of genres. I mean, what's the difference? We didn't talk about metal and heavy metal
speed metal
and, you know, like and like that whole other side, you know, that there's huge, amazing arguments about Black Sabbath versus Deep Purple versus Steppenwolf versus Iron, but where did this come from? You know, blah blah blah. You know, and it the arguments are very passionate, and I look and I say, well, I really can't tell the difference between.
It came from the Vanilla Fudge, is where it came from. Well, it came from
Vanilla Fudge
and the Iron Butterfly. No, Vanilla Fudge. What was the other one? The Vanilla Fudge. Of that era, Vanilla Fudge, and was it Iron Butterfly?
Iron Butterfly was a big one, and Steppenwolf, of course. So those are
but Steppenwolf was different.
And they were Canadian, too.
They were Canadian.
BTO.
they're Canadian, Bachman, too.
Bachman, blame it on Canada. Bachman, Turner, Overdrive.
So what, the Guess Who, one of the great mishaps of the Hall of Fame,
has never
put them in, which I find...
Tom Jones is Canadian. He's not right.
I don't know what Tom Jones is. He's an underpants guy.
So what is Tom? What genre is Tom Jones?
Oh, he's a crooner. Wilson.
He's a crooner?
Oh, yeah, he's a crooner.
A crooner. He's a crooner. A crooner.
Like Sinatra. He is a Sinatra, a later day Sinatra.
It's like Dino.
Oh, that's a great guy.
So there's a Tom Jones, Chrissy Hynde duet.
No way.
Doing Iggy Pop's Lust for Life.
Okay, and on that note, I think I'm bringing this discussion to a close.
How does it sound?
Well, he had to change the lyrics.
Richard, I think I'm bringing this discussion to an end
it's
quickly.
It's pretty interesting. Okay.
Thank you and good night.
Thank you and good night.
Try the veal.
I'll be here all week.
Well, that was fun.
That was a solid hour's worth.